The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Backstory. Let's Hear It on Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee with Roberta McCulloch-Dews. Thanks for tuning in. So today we are talking once again with noted historian and educator, Dr. Francis Jones Sneed. We've had the privilege of having Dr. Jones Sneed on the show before to talk about her personal story. But today she's back to share the story of a few historic locations in Berkshire County. Our goal is to get as many locations in as possible, but if we do not, she will be back on the show. So Dr. Jones Sneed, are you ready to get started?
Sure am.
All right, so we're going to start our journey in Pittsfield on 3rd Street, to be precise, 82 3rd Street. And there's a little house nestled at that location. And if you really didn't know the history of the house, you would probably drive right by. But there are a few indicators that there's something special about this home. It belonged to the Reverend Samuel Harrison, who was a noted figure in American history. Could you talk a little bit about Reverend Samuel Harrison and the significance of the home that has actually stood the test of time for nearly 200 years?
Yes, I think it's really great that we're starting in Pittsfield and that we're starting with Reverend Harrison's house, because it shows that talking about Black places in the Berkshires, that we're just not talking about places that are a footnote in history, but really, really important and essential history that everybody should know. Reverend Harrison came to the Berkshires in 1850, to a minister at the first Black church founded in Berkshire County, which was a Second Congregational Church. Reverend Harrison was born enslaved in Philadelphia in 1818. He trained as a shoemaker under his uncle there in Philadelphia, but at 18, he had a religious call. And his mother was Presbyterian, and she attended the Black Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. And in fact, the family get their denominational leanings from the people who enslaved them in Savannah, Georgia. Because when we really talk about Black ministers like Reverend Harrison, we usually think of the AME Zion, Black Baptist, Methodist. We think about those churches. But here is a man who went the Congregational and Presbyterian route, which very few Black ministers did. So this is really kind of really significant, especially in the Berkshire and in New England. But here, when he comes to Pittsfield in 1850, he brings his wife and his children in the middle of winter, and so that's kind of familiar in 1850. And he says he thinks that the snow came up to his knees, and they went on. They first had a house over on Pontusic Lake, which was even colder at that point in period of time. But after a couple of months, they did find a house on 3rd Street. And then about 2 or 3 years later, he found the property that we are talking about at 82 3rd Street. He buys the property, but then he needs to build a house. And so he has to get a loan to build a house. And he gets a loan of $300, $100 from three people. Yeah. And then he builds the house. He doesn't like owing people this money. And so he goes to what is now Berkshire Bank to get a loan. Mm-hmm. And they do give him a loan at a really stiff rate. And he kind of talks about that. But it was really amazing at this point in time because this is in 1853 or four. And we have to ask, what does freedom mean for Black folk in New England and Berkshire County at this point period of time? Very few Black people owned property. And so here is Reverend Harrison buying this property, $300. He doesn't get very much from the church because the church has less than 20 members. 20 members, can you imagine that? So he has to keep up with his shoe, his cobbling as a business. His wife is a seamstress, so she sews out of the house. So he does different things. He becomes a kind of a figure in the community for Black folks because he's the only Black minister at that point in period of time. The AME Zion is going to be much later within. The Black people in town who does not attend the Second Congregational Church attend predominantly white churches. But when
Dr. Joan Sneed, that's a good point that you make about the time. You painted a really great picture, and I know you're about to get into something that was really juicy. But if we could just go into the landscape of the period, the time, obviously it was an anomaly from what I'm hearing that he was able to even have this property. You know, the fact that he got this loan at a stiff rate, he still got it. He still got the loan, and he was able to do this. What was the community like around him or at this time? Like, what was life like?
There were very the population in Pittsfield at that period of time. Black folks have been in Pittsfield from the very, very beginning, but still their numbers were very small. They were about 3% of the population who were African American at that period of time. And on Third Street where he lived, there were just working class people, but mostly they were white. And the church at that point in time was on First Street. And so he would walk from his house on Third Street across the Pittsfield Common right into his church. So it was just a straight shot for him to walk from his house to the church and then downtown. So that was kind of his world at that point in period of time. The church as it exists today, was only it was not until the 1940s that that church changed, and so Reverend Harrison never knew anything except that church on First Street. So yes, and so Black people were lived in kind of really different kind of areas. It was not really until the 1920s and the 1930s that we get the accumulation of Black people on the west side of Pittsfield. Because I think when we think about Pittsfield and we think about Black life, we think about the west side. The west side was, I think it was really created on purpose. First for Jewish people, Irish people, Italian people, who were outside of the main, and they didn't want people living in their neighborhood, and so that's where they sent them. And so when the majority of Black people came during the Great Migration, the only people that would open up for them are those other immigrants on the west side that opened up for them. But when Harrison was living during that period of time, Black people were scattered all over Pittsfield. They didn't have just one conglomerated area that Black people were actually living. So,
That's interesting to know.
yeah.
And so, okay, so now we know that he is this pastor, but there's something also that I think you have not shared yet about Reverend Harrison, and that is his connection to the 54th.
Yes. Reverend, right before the end of the Civil War, Reverend Harrison had a kind of falling out with Second Congregational, and so he pulled away from them. And he was working for something called the Freedmen's Society. And this Freedmen's Society collected monies and clothing for people down in the South, especially in the South Carolina area, who had been displaced because of the Civil War, mostly black folk. So he was working for that organization. He was in touch with Frederick Douglass, who was an abolitionist, who was trying to push, was pushing Abraham Lincoln to allow black men to enter the as soldiers for the Civil War. Lincoln didn't want to do that because he thought that that would be push the border states like Missouri and Tennessee. They would say, hey, you're letting black men in. We don't want anything to do with that. But after he wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, he decided that he was going to allow black soldiers in, kind of like as a ploy against the Southerners, you know, to kind of rub it in their face. And so one of the very first regiments to be formed was the 54th in Massachusetts. Samuel Harrison recruited men in Pittsfield to serve in the 54th. So when the 54th troop was literally, I think, almost massacred because they lost half of their men in the battle at Fort Wagner, the governor of Massachusetts wanted a minister to go down, you know, to talk to the troops and to commiserate with them, to pray with them. And who did he choose? Samuel Harrison. And wow. it was amazing because here's this man in Pittsfield, which, you know, no one in Massachusetts really thinks anything of the Berkshires. Where is the Berkshire? Western Mass. And there he is in Boston, and in Boston it's really lively. There are a slew of black ministers in Boston. So why would he choose this man from this very small place?
Why did he?
We only have speculation of why he did so. Because I think because Harrison was a congregational minister.
Okay.
And the president of Williams College, Congregationalist, friends with the governor, recommends Harrison because Harrison has such an appeal to the people in power. Harrison knew everybody. He knew the governor before he knew like three governors on private terms. In fact, we're talking about that $300 that he raised from three people. One of those people was an ex-governor, Briggs, that he borrowed the money from.
So that he was really social then. He was a very outgoing figure.
Yes, he, and I think Dennis Dickerson, who's a historian at Vanderbilt, and did one of the first papers on Reverend Harrison, said that Reverend Harrison had to be a diplomat because the church could not afford to pay him that much. So he had to make inroads with the white elite of the Berkshires, and he did that. The people that he write about, like Brig, and then here is this governor choosing him as the chaplain. So we know that he had some heavy weight one way or the other. So he was the most important black man in Berkshire County at that point in period of time. So
you mentioned that he had associations with Frederick Douglass. Would it be safe to say they were friends?
I think that it would be safe to say it was friend. Unfortunately, Reverend Harrison kept a diary, but that diary was lost in some way. But yes. because two of Frederick Douglass's sons were in the 54th Regiment. And yes, Frederick Douglass came through Berkshire County. And so he knew all of the movers and shakers at that point in period of time, all of the top abolitionist figures. Harrison knew them and had communications with them. So, yes.
But he was connected. So Reverend Harrison was well connected.
Reverend Harrison was well connected. When you read his autobiography, I mean, you're talking about somebody who's name throwing. He just puts those names out there as if everybody knows who these people were. And they were some of the leading lights of the day that he was actually talking about, the black as well as white, you know. And so it is just amazing the connections, as you said, that he has. And Harrison ministered, there were five congregational churches, black congregational churches in New England. Harrison was a minister for four of those churches.
So that means he traveled around.
He traveled around. As I said, he broke with Second Congregational for a while. Mm-hmm. And he went to the black congregational church in Maine.
In Maine.
And then from Maine, he went to Rhode Island.
Okay.
And from Rhode Island, he went to Springfield. But he spent like 2 or 3 years at each one of those churches before he came back around to finally come back to the Second Congregational, where he stayed for the last 20 something years of his ministry and his life. So
when we think about, you're painting quite the picture of this man who is social, and he's able to champion the rights of the common man, but yet he's rubbing shoulders with those in the upper echelons, right? And
yes.
So he has this finesse about him. Do we know anything about just, you know, his little personality? I mean, beyond the showmanship, was he quiet in, you know, when people weren't around him? Did he like to have that time? Is there anything, I know the diary doesn't exist, but any other glimpses into him as the man?
The only glimpses that we have of him is that autobiography, which is only 40 pages. Mm-hmm. And then he gave sermons and he printed those sermons. And so we have three of those sermons. And it seems to me that he was a very quiet man, really a family man. He and his wife had 13 children, but only, I think only three came to full adulthood. Most of them, you know, kind of died in infancy. Yeah. Or in young adulthood. And so he was really a family man, but just listening to or reading his sermons, he's almost academic. He tells a historical story, and he's always trying to get over, and he's always speaking to almost not just his congregation, but to the broader country and world, and especially whites.
Yeah.
That black folk really are people, they are human. Mm-hmm. And they have something to offer and to give the country, and whites should take them very seriously as far mm-hmm. as that is concerned. And he finds Bible passages and stories connected to that to mm-hmm. back him up in that kind of way. So it's very, very interesting, but it's not the kind, he does not do the kind of sermon that we see in Black Baptist or Black Methodist or AME mm-hmm. churches. He doesn't preach in those kind of way. So I think that he was just a very quiet man who, a quiet family man, but he really believed in the African American people.
Okay.
That was his whole thing, that he wanted to do that so well.
That's a perfect segue, taking us back to being a family man, 82 Third Street. And at 82 Third Street, for those who haven't visited the house, it's a tiny little house.
By our standards today.
By our standards, but that's a good point. So let's think about it by the standards of almost, 170 plus years ago. Was that a common size house? Did most people have a house that size?
I think that, that house would have been a working class household. And I think all of the houses on that street was there were working class houses. If you look at Pittsfield, they are really huge homes that are almost mansion-like. And so Third Street seems to be a street where working class people or people who had their own businesses, like Harrison had a workshop down in the basement of this house where people could come and get their shoes, cobble if they wished to do it. So it was not only the family home, but it was also his business that he had right there. As I said, his wife as well as his daughter were seamstress. And so, his children were very, very smart and brilliant. One graduated as a valedictorian in her class. And he talks about education as well and the need for education. And he was a radical in some way. When they did the Fugitive Slave Act the church, well, it was just not the church, but it was black folk in Pittsfield came together and decided that if any slave catcher came to Pittsfield, that they were not going to have it. And so a man came to Harrison's house and said that they thought that there was a slave catcher down at one of the hotels. There were like three big hotels down in Pittsfield. And the house on Third Street, is just a few blocks from downtown Pittsfield. So Harrison said he got up, he put his clothes on, and he rushed down, and he rushed into the hotel, and there's this man sitting. And so Harrison goes over to the man, and he said, "It was an abolitionist by the name of Tappan, a very famous abolitionist." And so they sat down and they had a big laugh about the whole thing. But
What was
I have no idea.
gonna do?
But I mean that they had decided that they were not going to have any slave keepers. The man came and said, "Reverend Harrison, there's one," and off he goes. You know what I'm saying? I have no idea what in the heck he was going to do, but had this man actually been a slave catcher. But he has one of the sermons he had to preach over 2 Sundays, and it's called Pittsfield 25 Years Ago. And he talks about that Pittsfield, the old American Hotel, served as a kind of a refuge for runaway slaves, especially during this time. New York and Connecticut, slavery had not been abolished, and so slaves came across the Connecticut and the New York border. They would come into Pittsfield, and the man at the American Hotel would actually hire them. And so, a woman had run away from Albany and had been given a job at the American Hotel. And the owner came because he heard that she was there. The guy sent the woman to Lanesboro, to a place in Lanesboro for protection. And then they just stonewalled this guy. Harrison went down again and they stonewalled a guy. And so, and he said, he told them, people don't like, slave catchers here. In fact, I think that there is a group that may be coming. And this man got on his horse and left, in a real hurry because he didn't want to face any kind of crowd or anything like that. But really telling the story of Harrison's kind of connection with the business community as well in Pittsfield, with the American Hotel being kind of a refuge that would hire ex-slaves or runaway slaves, as it were called.
It seems a little bit progressive in a way.
Well, this it was very progressive
Yeah.
in that way. In that, and then he was involved in this as well. So, that they were very proactive, that they were not going to have this in Pittsfield. Even with such a small population, they felt that they had allies that would support them in this
Yeah.
whole kind of thing. Isn't that interesting? So here's this tiny house on 82 Third Street where this man lived, and the Samuel Harrison Society in 2015 refurbishes this house as a house museum. And I think that's important for us to tell the audience that this house is there, and we certainly like for people to visit, right? To
Yes.
get a feel of it, because you walk in the door, and I think that that was kind of the kitchen, the kind of dining room. To the left would be the parlor. And then going up the stairs, there are three bedrooms. And three bedrooms at that point in time for a working class family, I think that's pretty great. At that point in time. And then downstairs is where he had his workshop, and his business down there. So,
I think what always strikes me, Dr. Jones-Need, is the it's the roof
Oh.
off some of these old homes, because it makes you realize people were short. And I'm like, I could fit right in, I have found my people, right?
I don't think that Reverend Harrison was any more than 5'8". I think if he were 5'8", he was tall. 5'8" was tall for that point in time. But yeah,
They
so.
were definitely shorter people, but I think what you have mentioned is so important, that we have this history that is nestled within the everyday,
Yes.
and it's there. And if you don't know the story, you would pass by this home, or even if you never had any reason to turn down on Third Street, you would never even know it exists. But to know we have such a connection to the Civil War, to early Pittsfield history, to the Black community that lived here, there are so many layers of history that intertwine. And then when you also talk about the people of Pittsfield and the allyship and the support and how they supported the people, it is something that we always don't hear about. It's not something that is known. Why? Because we don't, that kind of history, sometimes you forget about it. You forget about it, but it's important to say. And it's when you mentioned that Frederick Douglass actually came to Pittsfield, I was like, what? Frederick Douglass came to Pittsfield? Like, seriously, I mean, that kind of thing, who knew?
Yeah.
Because he
Well,
becomes
what
such a figure on a poster somewhere,
Oh, I
right?
know. Well, the Berkshires have always had luminaries. Booker T. Washington came through Berkshires. Martin Luther King Jr.'s came through the Berkshires. So hey, some people knew that we existed, right? And certainly, the Black luminaries knew that the Berkshires existed. And here we had a man that had national connections, because Harrison went all over New England, but he also went back and forth to Philadelphia and New York as well. So he was always on the cutting edge, that he knew what was going on in the nation. So he was a very well-read man.
I have another question to follow up on that, but we do have to take a quick break. When we do return, I have a question about what Reverend Harrison read, and then we're going to leave Pittsfield, and then we're going to head into our journey into Dalton. So we'll be right back.
You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield and 88.1 WSBR Lee. Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
For my listeners just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Frances Jones Sneed, and we were getting into a journey of historic places. Normally, we do a backstory on people, but our backstory episodes for a little bit will be dedicated to some locations that we have right here in Berkshire County. And we started our journey in the city of Pittsfield with the home of the Dr. Reverend Samuel Harrison. And he was the first pastor of the Second Congregational Church, as well as the chaplain for the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. So much history we have been getting into, Dr. Jones Sneed. You mentioned that Reverend Harrison was a learned man. What did he read in terms of, like, what was the newspaper of the day?
I think the newspapers of the day were the local newspapers. I mean, he, if you read the what we now call the Berkshire Eagle, you know, the prior to the Berkshire Eagle and then the Berkshire Eagle, you will find Harrison's name appearing almost every month, you know, because they cover what he did and where he went and all of that kind of stuff. He wrote, you know, he wrote into the papers as well. He read the one from Springfield, because Springfield was the kind of nearest in the state to another community of blacks, you know, and because he had that connection with the black community in Springfield. So he read that paper. In fact, when he died, they had a big spread on about him. And of course, the Boston papers, as well as the New York. And of course, he read the Philadelphia paper, because that was his home city. So,
that's right.
Yeah. So, but he kept up with those, as well as what was going on, not only politically, but religiously in the world. So, you know, he was very well read as well biblically,
yes.
As well. And so Randy Weinstein down in Great Barrington has about half a dozen books that came from Reverend Harris's library, you know, and so it's very interesting that we get to see, to touch these books that he kind of thumbed through and looked through and that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Just very interesting.
Wow, that's special. I mean, to actually look through the actual, like, feel it.
Yes, yes.
So we're leaving Pittsfield. We're in our, obviously we're not in a little car. Let's take it back to time travel, right? So the mode of transportation back in the day, which I guess would be, I don't know,
horse and buggy, or
horse and buggy,
or walking, you know,
Be a long time though. That's
yes.
You'd be walking for days.
From Pittsfield to Dalton?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not, we think of, I don't know. I mean, am I exaggerating? Maybe a few hours, I guess.
Maybe a few hours. Yeah.
Maybe a few hours.
Yeah.
So we're going to go to Gulf Road in Dalton.
Six Gulf Road.
That's right. Six Gulf Road, absolutely, to be precise. And there's a tiny little house nestled on the corner. It's a yellow house. And I will tell you that it first caught my attention when there's a trailhead and I was going for a hike. And I said, this house is so unusual. It's unusual for several reasons. It's tiny, but it's well preserved. There's a marker out front, right, that shows that it's on the National Registry of Historic Places.
As is the Harrison House.
Yes, that is correct too. But it stands out because it doesn't look like anything else in that part of the community. And so knowing that that community always didn't look like that. Can you take us, can we do some time travel? Yeah, I think we were either on horse buggy or foot, but can we go back to what that community looked like when people were going in and out of the Fitch Hughes house? What did it look like back then?
I think that your going up to the trail, that area used to be called the Gulf, Gulf. And if you go up, as you went up hiking, you went hiking, that was a black community during
In
those,
there?
in there, that was a black community. And the Fitch Hughes House is the last remnant of the African American community in Dalton. So that is the significance of that house, because up in the area that you go hiking, there was an entire black community. Need to be careful here, because people always like to talk about the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
So the story was that the Gulf was part of the Underground Railroad, where people could come and stay while they were en route to a place of freedom. And unfortunately, we've lost. It would be really wonderful if somebody did an archaeological dig in that area, because there's supposed to be graves as well as other things up there. There are supposed to be foundations that were house sites and those kinds of things. And over time, we don't have the information of exactly what happened, but all of that's gone now. And the Fitch Hughes house is the only one that kind of survives that we can kind of point to, of people who were just ordinary, everyday people. They were not the Reverend Samuel Harrison. They were not the chaplain of the 54th. And I think it's important when we talk about black life in the Berkshires, that this is an example of people living everyday lives, trying to survive in one way or the other, trying to help each other to freedom or to survive in this environment where they are the minority, really the minority within that kind of thing. It's interesting about the Hughes house, that it's really, really, really small. And what happened in the mid-19th century, if you've ever been in the Hughes house, you go in it, and right now, the way it has been remodeled, you go in and it's a very long room. You go to the left, and they've made a kind of a bedroom that you can kind of look in. But then you look to the right, and you look up, and there's the attic. And it's a very tall attic. And that's where I guess the children of the family must have been, in the family, in that kind of, in the attic kind of thing. Of course, you're not allowed to go up in the attic, but do give you a view of the attic in one way or the other. But it is just so quite interesting. I mean, I did the history of African Americans in Berkshire County, and this was one of the last places that I actually got a chance to kind of look and see, because nobody thinks about Dalton, and African American, especially being right next door to Pittsfield, where the majority of African Americans probably lived in the county at that point period of time. So
Why that area? It seems there's so many things that you said just now that strike me as so interesting. The fact that the trail is basically built or has been carved out of a community. So I've walked this trail many times. It's huge, right? You can go in many different directions. And it makes me now, when I return to it, there's a level of almost like a level of sacredness to it, that this
Yes,
was like
yes, yes,
a
yes.
former community that
Yes, yeah.
I am being a part of in some kind of way. There's no remnant of it. There's no marker. There's no nothing.
No,
And I
nothing.
would not have known that, because in my mind, I have to be honest, in my mind, I thought like the community was like the houses we see today, that they were like the old houses, like the Fitchu's house. They were knocked down and you put up these modern structures.
Right.
They had no idea. I did not know that you were going to go there. I did not know that you were going to talk about that the community was in the trail.
Yeah, yes.
Wow.
It is so fascinating, because the Who's house was not foreclosed until 2004. I mean, it's still in the possession of African Americans through 2004 when they took it for taxes, and then the restoration began by the Historical Society in Dalton. And so good for them that they got the house and restored the house, and so we have this symbol there at least of what Black life was all about. But
It's telling that it's the I'm fascinated that they were able to hold on to it for so long. It's telling that it's the literally the only thing, the only marker
yes,
of
that's
what once was.
yes. And there are descendants of Charles Hoos, and I understand that they do a visit often and come back. And if you visit the Hoos house, the steward of the house is a very enthusiastic woman who will tell you about their visit. And so,
Okay.
so there are descendants who do not live in Massachusetts anymore, but they know about their ancestors and who lived in the Who's house, and they're still very, very interested in it. So, I mean, I love that kind of story because we're talking about 10 million names, right? In the NAACP meeting the other night. So trying to find descendants of enslaved people. And so we have so many connections here in the Berkshires of Black life, and then the descendants of those, people. It's just some really amazing. But you got my brain working, can we start a project to unearth the history of the other people of the Gulf during that period of time?
It makes I'm fascinated by it.
It would be very, very fascinating to do that, right?
It makes me think of Seneca Village in
Mm,
Central Park,
part, yes.
and how people visit Central Park today and would not even know that there was once this Black community that was there called Seneca Village,
But, right.
and that it was taken, I presumably by eminent domain. I
Right,
think that they were
right.
like, we need the property, we
Right,
need to
right.
have this park, and
Right,
you
right.
have to go. So,
Right. Isn't that the
but I I think I've seen some images where they say there's like structural remnants that if you didn't know what you were looking at, perhaps you would just pass it and it would be like whatever.
Yeah.
But there are certain remnants that still remain from that community,
Unity.
and it makes me think now about the Gulf, and as I'm walking, just have a different eye. I don't know. Maybe my eye will start picking up things that aren't even there. And I'm like, is this like a structure? No, that's just old trash. Like, that's not what that is. But it really makes you think about the history that, again, we walk by every day, that's embedded in our everyday life, that we don't even know about. We're blind to, not because sometimes we're just blind to it, but because we don't even know it's there. And wow, the Gulf is representative of that. I think,
And so that goes back to a kind of name that was given to one of the first projects that looked at African American life in the Berkshires, calling it the invisible community. That it something is there, but you just something that's in plain sight, but you don't see it or know about it, in that way. And so that's the exciting part about I think doing history is finding out these little tidbits, or you
Yeah.
know, bringing it to fore to people that you know there was something, somebody's something here. There was a thriving community here of people trying to make you know a living and make do. So where the Harrison House is still situated and still connected with a larger kind of community, this house sits there as a remnant of what a community.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I have peered inside the window
Yeah.
because I've done that, and I'm like, that's the only thing I can do to get a sense of what it looks like
Right,
inside because
right.
it's closed.
Yeah.
But very fascinating. And I think the people who have come before us, they leave certain things, right? Whether it's the structures that they
Right,
once lived in,
right, right.
items that they once used.
Used, uh-huh.
Everything tells a story.
Story, yes.
Everything tells a story. Well, we're gonna make our way now. We're leaving Dalton and we're gonna head down to Great Barrington. And
Oh, okay.
I know that, in considering who we're going to visit, his childhood home, W.E.B. Du Bois,
Yes,
I know a lot can be said about him. So I already know, looking at the time, that we're gonna have to have a part two because we're gonna have to get into more of his home site. But the W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site is in Great Barrington, and that encompasses, it's a trail, and we get to, the first stop in that trail really is his home site on Egremont Road. For those who have not traversed the trail, what is that experience like, and can they do it without a guide?
Yes, they certainly can. It's really great that the UMass's public history program that there was a group of that called Friends of the Du Bois Boyhood Home Site. And for years, that site, which is kind of 5 acres in a horseshoe and a kind of a horseshoe form, you couldn't visit it because it was so grown up. It had poison ivy and all that kind of stuff in there. And so, please, babe. you couldn't do anything. And so maybe 10 years ago, we convinced UMass, who is the steward of that property, in 1969, it was deeded over to UMass. It's very, very important because Du Bois calls that spot the House of the Black Burkharts. And he has an essay called The House of the Black Burkharts. He was born on Church Street, right by the Housatonic River, right downtown Great Barrington. He lived there with his mother until he was like three years old. His mother and father were there for 2 years, and then his father left. And then his mother, being on her own, felt that she needed to go back to her family home, which was this home on Egremont, on the Egremont Plain, or the House of the Black Burkharts. And so he spent his early boyhood in this place. And he loved it so much that it went through family, generations of family it went through. And so the history of that place starts with the Du Bois, and then there are other family names that lived in that house and on that property. But then they lost it. And Du Bois dreamed of coming back to the Berkshires and building something on that spot. In 1928, he was working for the NAACP, and for his 60th birthday present, the NAACP and his friends purchased that piece of land for Du Bois, and he was so happy about it. And in his in the archives, he has all these plans of how he's going to rebuild this house. In fact, the house was still there when he retained the property in 1928, but it was just a shell of the house, and it was nothing that could be refurbished or remodeled. And then there was just a chimney there. And so if you go around the kind of horseshoe and come to the very end of the horseshoe, you'll see a part of the foundation of the house that was there. He never got to build that house again because he ran into legal difficulties with the U.S. government on the House on American Activities that called him a communist. And
Was
actually,
that under McCarthy?
this was under McCarthy, and saying that he was a foreign agent. And so he had to get legal a defense, and so he had to sell the property in order, to do this. So, but he owns it from 28 until in the 1950s when he had to sell it. So in 1968, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, two gentlemen, one white, one black, decided that they should buy this property and dedicate it back to the image of Du Bois. And so in 1969, that was a big rally. Julian Bond, Ossie Davis, you just all of the luminaries came
We
to,
were here.
they were here, and they would, but also was the FBI and other people, because they thought, that there was going to be, a riot or something like that. The people of Great Barrington's didn't like it because they didn't particularly care for Du Bois, because they also called him a communist. And so this space is so important that it's still there, and that it's been turned into kind of, I call it a kind of a sacred space. What UMass has done is the public history people, they have put kind of placards around the property, so that you at every I think that there are like 10 or 12 placards that you can read as you go along the trail. So that now that they have a little small parking area, so you can pull in, park your car, and then go just walk the horseshoe. And there are these tall trees. They are mostly pine. And in the summertime and in the spring, it is just such a sacred, almost religious kind of place, that you can kind of feel
You
the,
feel something.
you feel the energy, the of the people who walk that, who were there. And one time I just bent down and I put my hand on the ground, and it seems that you could just feel that kind of energy come up and, enter your body. So that's the way I feel about the place. And so, you've been to the place, so.
I've been, but I need to. I'm also going back this spring, and I might be taking a group of some students. How long is the tour if I were to have like stop and go, stop and go, stop and
I
go?
think it could be like 30 to 40 minutes. There's a group from Miss Hall's that's going on April 1st.
April 1st.
I hope it's a good day for them. And they did it last year, and they're going to do it again this year. They're touring Great Barrington, because Bernard Drew pulled together this document, which calls the 50 sites of Du Bois in Great Barrington. And so, but they're not doing the 50 sites, but they're going to Cyril's High, what used to be Cyril's High School, which Du Bois graduated from as a valedictorian. They're going to the spot where his birthplace was. They're going to the River Garden, which is named after Du Bois, you know. They're going there. They're going to the Mahaley Cemetery, where Du Bois' first wife and his two children and his only granddaughter are interred. But then they're going to the Boyhood Home site that we're talking about on Egremont Plain, and that's their last stop. And I think that it's really kind of fitting that that's their last stop, you know, because it's such a great place, I think, to, you know, to stop and kind of wrap up that story of Du Bois, you know, and that place, you know. So here we have a place that produced a world famous intellectual. Yes. He probably was the greatest intellectual of the 20th century. I mean, a lot of people call him the greatest African-American intellectual of the 20th century. I call him the greatest intellectual of the 20th century. Right here in the Berkshires, right there in Great Barrington, you know. And and it had to be a fight for people, for the people to recognize this man and to embrace him as a citizen of that place, you know, just because of some a political kind of buzz about this man. But of course, you know that they indeed now have a statue of Du Bois.
There's a statue.
Right in front of
there was quite the party last year.
Yes. In front of the town's library, they a statue of Du Bois sitting out there with his outstretched hand, which I always say, and then, you know, that when we talk about the next person is going to be Elizabeth Freeman, who also has a statue in her commemoration. And I'm not a big person about statues. I always believe in the here and now, and the kind of money that you have to put in order to do a statue and to maintain that statue. It seems, I thought, just reading Du Bois, that he would want that money to go toward the living, to young people, to make sure that they got their education, because he had to scrap so hard. You know, people had to pay for his education. He would have never gotten the education had people not come together to pay for his education. But be that as it is may, when you asked me to do this, and then I was going back trying to think about, you know, who or where are the places we should talk about. I was reading something, and you know, and I changed my mind, you know, that commemorative statues and things like that are also for the living now, but it's for the generation to come, to say to those generation that these people mattered, that not only this person Du Bois or this person Elizabeth Freedom, but African Americans, Black people in the Berkshires, you know, mattered, and they matter so much that we want to commemorate them in this way. So,
well, on that note, because we absolutely have to have a part two, because we've run out of time. But we are going to have a part two. You are going to return. See how I'm just telling you, Dr. Jones, and I'm like, you are going to return for part two. But I would love if you are able to for us to continue the conversation in the next episode, to continue our journey through South County, and explore our, you know, as we wrap up W.E.B. Du Bois, we can touch a little bit more about him in the next episode. And then we can talk about Elizabeth Freeman and get into her story and her journey. So, you know, I hope that, you know, this was, you know, I know that this is your passion, this is your love. And I hope that our listeners today also enjoy the backstory off these locations because, again, just like people, we have stories. So too do these locations that we pass by every day. They too tell a story and have this hidden history that we often don't know about. So I thank you, Dr. Jones Sneed, for making the time to come and share this wonderful retrospective about Black history in the Berkshires. Thank you so much. And it is Black history, but also American history. I always like to say that because it is weaved into the fabric of this country. So thank you so much for the journey. We're going to continue it in the next episode. And to my listeners, you've been listening to Backstory. Let's hear it on Pittsfield Community Radio. Thank you, and I hope you tune in again next week.